I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. It's time for another episode of The Short Stacks, our shorter conversations with authors about their books and their process. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas. Today, our guest is Lacey M. Johnson, author of one of my favorite books of 2018, The Reckonings. Before we dive in, I'm going to remind you about a few little things. First, if you're listening to The Stacks and enjoying the show, you have the amazing Stacks Pack to thank. Those are people who listen and love the podcast and have decided to contribute as little as $1 a month to make the show a reality. In addition to knowing that they're supporting the Stacks, they also get perks for themselves, like shout outs on the show and taking part in our virtual book club and more. So if this sounds like something you might be interested in, go to patreon.com/thestacks and help make the Stacks a reality. If you prefer one-time contributions, check out paypal.me/thestackspod. Another way to help the Stacks is to write a review for the podcast on Apple Podcasts. You just rate the show and leave a small message about why you like what we're doing. If you're not already, take a moment to follow the Stacks on our social media. You can find links to all of our social media accounts in the show notes. Also in the show notes are links to everything we talk about on the show. So if you click through those links to do any shopping on Amazon, the Stacks earns a small commission. It's a total win-win. Okay, now it's time for our conversation with Lacey M. Johnson. Lacey is a professor, activist, curator, and the author of 3 books. Today, we're discussing her newest book, a collection of essays called The Reckonings. All right, Lacey Johnson is here with me today. Thank you so much for joining us on The Stacks.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, good. Well, that feeling is definitely mutual. Lacey is the author of The Reckonings, which is her most recent book. She's also written 2 other books, but we're going to focus mostly today on The Reckonings and on Lacey's process. So in about 30 seconds or less, can you kind of tell us about the book?
So this is a book that's about justice, because while I was on tour for The Other Side, which is my previous book, my memoir, which is about the time that I got kidnapped and raped by my ex, people kept asking me, what do you want to have happen to the person who did this to you? You probably want him dead, right? And I didn't want him dead, but it just really confused me why people would want that for me and for him. And so I began asking myself, well, if that isn't justice, as I think it's not, what is?
Right. And then you kind of just wrote a bunch of essays about justice.
Yeah, I did write a bunch of essays about justice.
And they're all amazing. Everybody knows that I'm obsessed with this book. So I'm going to try to like not talk about how great it is, but it is great. And if you haven't read it yet, I'm going to tell you that you should read it. Not that I believe in required reading, but it's kind of required reading. Why did you feel compelled to turn this into a book of essays? Like, what drove you to actually write it as opposed to just kind of meditating on your own about it?
I mean, I think writing essays or writing in general is just the way that I figure out the world. You know, I think, like a lot of people, the world, I experience the world as strange and confusing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, writing is the way that I come to understandings about things that confuse or horrify or terrify me. And so, you know, that's why I wrote the essays, and, you know, why I wrote them as essays rather than as a memoir, say, is just because it's about so many things. And I couldn't figure out how to do it as like a single narrative, because the 12 essays are about such, you know, seemingly radically different things. It made the most sense to just split them up that way. But also the way that I approach essay writing is, you know, I come to it with a question, and the question that I was asking was specific to each of the situations that I was writing about.
And you cover a lot of topics in your essays. You talk about sexual violence and rape. You talk about whiteness. You talk about the death penalty, mm-hmm. kids with cancer, writing in a political climate that feels like garbage, you know, Hurricane Harvey. You're talking about all these very different things. And I feel like even just listing them now, they feel so different.
Right.
Which things were the hardest for you to write about, and which things kind of came easily?
I don't think any of them came easily. This is a really, really hard book to write in a lot of different ways. From like a craft perspective, I'll start there because that's the easier thing to talk about, right? You know, I think for me, the way that my process works is it takes me most of the time that I'm working on an essay, I spend trying to figure out what kind of structure it has. Like, how do I bring these different things together? Because even though the book is about, you know, each essay is about these different things, within each essay, there's a lot going on also. You know, the essay called On Mercy, for instance, is about, you know, kids who are dying of cancer, as well as about the death penalty. Right. And so figuring out how to bring these things that I sort of know are related, but I don't know how they're related, together into a conversation, that takes me most of the time that I spend working on the essay. And it takes the same amount of time whether I'm working on an essay or whether I'm working on a memoir. Mm-hmm. So to do it 12 times took forever. And it was really hard and exhausting to write, to figure this sort of structural problem out 12 different times. So it was hard in that way. But then it was also difficult because, you know, in my previous books, which are both memoirs, I'm writing about my own experience. And especially in the second memoir, In the Other Side, you know, I'm writing about really difficult material, and it was hard to write about. But one of the things that did not make it hard was, you know, carrying the pain of that experience, because I had already become so accustomed to carrying it. Mm. You know, it had happened 13 years before I finished the book. And so with this book, with The Reckonings, I am sort of writing from my own perspective as a person who has survived this kind of horrifying trauma, but looking outward and sort of thinking about the pain of other people and engaging with them. And one of the things that was hard about it that I wasn't prepared for is carrying the weight of the pain of other people. Yeah. And that was just, you know, I think in my imagination, I thought, well, I can just, you know, kind of dip into this story and pop back out after I'm done writing the essay, and I won't, you know, and that'll be fine. But it was not fine. And I found that I couldn't do that. And once I started writing about someone, I was writing with them and in allegiance with them, and sort of took their pain as my own. And so that was challenging as well.
Right. And how long did it take you to write this book?
I think I worked on this book about 4 years. I'm trying to remember when I began. I guess I began it in 2014, in the fall of 2014, when I was on tour for The Other Side. Mm. And then I finished it December of 18. So a little over 4 years.
Wow. And is The Reckonings, that first title article, Is that, or essay, is that where you started the book? Like, was that always the first one?
No. I knew that that essay would be the first in the book, but it was not the first one that I wrote. The first one that I wrote that I knew was part of this book was the On Mercy essay.
Okay.
Because I had been giving a reading at Texas Tech University, and I got this question, what do you want to have happen to the man who did this to you? You probably want him dead, right? And I gave the answer, which was, you know, no, I don't want him dead. I want him to admit what he did to me in public and then to spend his life in service of other people, you know, to other people's joy. And I think it might have been the first time that I gave that answer, or I had been working toward that answer. But the person who had invited me there, this wonderful writer named Leslie Jill Patterson, she works in criminal justice and works on the death penalty. And she just sort of saw in that a kind of, you know, resonance with what the work that she did. And she gave me a copy of this book called Autobiography of an Execution by the writer David Dow.
Yeah.
And I read that book and I was like, oh, there's something here. I feel like he's working on the same thing that I'm working on, but or thinking about, but he's coming at it from a really different way. And then right after that, I read Just Mercy, by Brian Stevenson, which is a fantastic book. And so then, and I had just finished, you know, maybe the year before, teaching in a pediatric cancer ward, where, you know, some of my students, you know, died during the time that I was teaching them. And the kind of discourse and language around, you know, easing the suffering of children who are dying of cancer, it just, there was a lot of overlap with the, you know, language and discourse around capital punishment. And but people had really different intentions in the in what they meant by, you know, the term mercy, for example. But there was this, you know, in the Venn diagram, there's this huge area where there, it was the same language and the same, you know, way of talking, but people meant really different things. And so then I said, okay, well, I live in Texas, where that year when I was teaching in the pediatric cancer ward, you know, 13 men were executed. So it just seemed like I wanted to write about that. So I wrote about that. And when the essay was done, I said, okay, I don't feel like I've scratched the itch of this broader question. And so I think I better write a book. So that was when I started writing the book. But a couple of the essays that are in the collection were written, or versions of them were written before. And so one of those was, the what's now called Girlhood in a Semi-Barbarous Age had been a quite a different essay that had appeared before on Mercy. And maybe there's another one, but I can't remember if like Speak Truth to Power came before or after on Mercy.
Okay. And how did you know you were done? Like, how did, I mean, even more than how did you know you were done, how did you know what topics were going to go in? Because you wrote about so many disparate things, seemingly, that you really could have written about anything. The way that you write, it's kind of like you brought justice to the issues.
Right.
So how did you kind of know, like, yes, we're going to talk about nuclear waste, but no, we're not going to talk about, I don't know, Colin Kaepernick or whatever, you know, whatever it is.
Right. Well, I mean, in the... So once I started, you know, I'd written maybe two or three essays, you know, I wrote a proposal and for the book and just kind of laid out the essays that I thought that were to me that I had something of value to contribute to the conversation. And I think that's an important thing, that I don't necessarily think that my voice is the most important one in every conversation that is, you know, has to do with issues of justice, or issues of injustice, maybe that is. And so these were just the ones that I felt like I did have something, that my voice might be valuable. There was, you know, in the original plan, some essays that didn't end up getting written. One of them was an essay that was called White Hot Rage, which was about, sort of, I guess, you know, toxic masculinity and particularly conservative anger. And this, you know, I imagined that I was going to write about, you know, the people at the the Trump rallies who are just really mad about what seems to be everything going their way.
Right.
You know, like things seem to be very good for them and they're really, really mad about it. And, but, you know, really they're mad that other people are getting to have privileges and opportunities that they have. But, you know, I'm from Missouri and a lot of my family voted for Trump. And so I felt like I might have something to say about that. And when I wrote the proposal, I did not imagine that Trump was going to win the election. Mm. And so after he did, and then there were a million think pieces, right, about, you know, the anger of, you know, so-called what economically disadvantaged or whatever, you know, and I have many thoughts about that, but, but you know, there were a million think pieces about it. And then it just didn't seem like there was anything more to say about that because so many people had said so much already. And really it became clear that, those people didn't necessarily deserve to our focus and our attention anymore at all, ever. So, so I decided just not to work on that one. And I pulled it out and, I think replaced it with what became the Art in the Age of Apocalypse's essay, which is about artist activism. And so like how I knew I was done was I just wrote all the essays that I meant to write. And then my deadline came and went and, you know, my editor was saying, hey,
you're done.
Where's that book? Right.
It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Did the book ever have any other titles? Or was it always
maybe, but not that I would admit publicly. Like, okay. I think before it had this title, it didn't really have a title.
Okay.
And it was probably just had like a placeholder title. You know, and I remember when we were about to send it to publishers on proposal, it still didn't have a title. And then, you know, I think my agent was about to hit send and I was like, oh, wait, actually I thought of one. And that was The Reckonings. And it was just, so it's kind of always been the title that it's had.
Got it. And what about, the cover? Can you talk about it at all? I had some ideas of what I thought maybe it was. I know a lot of the essays had birds in it.
Yeah.
But then specifically, my thinking was that it was from, now I can't think of the name of the story with the sister. No, I'm literally the sister, the Greek story, the sisters. Mm-hmm. Is that to help me?
Oh, yeah. So that one is Speak Truth to Power, and it's got Philomela.
Yes, Philomela, there it is.
And her sister. So, yes, it's that. But as you say, there are a lot of birds in the book. I think what I was thinking was I was really interested in the motion studies of, you know, this photographer who I mention only in like it had been a bigger part of the essay called The Precarious was this sort of thinking about the history of photography, because photography is the technology through which we're able to see all these images of violence, or asked to look at all these images of violence constantly now, every single day. And so the history of photography at one time had been a bigger part of that essay. But in the final version, most of that is in the notes. But I was really interested in that, in those images. And if you look them up, they're really, I don't know, they're just fascinating. In particular, the images made by Jules Murray. I can't remember his first name. Etienne Jules Murray, maybe. And my French is atrocious, so that's not how it's like. Whatever that sounded like is not how it looks, and okay. It's not right. You know, it's like very early in the history of photography, and he shot them. He made a gun, like it was a photographic gun that he made to shoot birds in flight. And that I just thought was fascinating. And then looking at the images that he created from that were fascinating. And there was something about that idea of, you know, one bird at like many different stages in flight, mm-hmm. that I loved as a metaphor for these essays. So that it's the same question, but at different stages,
right.
And just, you know, in different state of motion across the entire book.
So you kind of always had that in mind for the cover, like, because sometimes I know authors come to a cover and they're like, they write their book and they're like, I don't know. And they hand it off to the publisher and they're like, here's six options. And then right. I've also heard that sometimes authors come to the book and they're like, no, it's very much this thing, or it has this feeling, or.
Right. Well, I think it was a combination of those things. So I think I wanted to see what they would come up with first. Mm-hmm. And they sent me some covers and they were not quite what I had in mind, right? And one of the things that I didn't like about the covers that they first came to me with, it was just so like literal. Like there was an image of a woman's, like of Lady Justice, mm-hmm. like the statue with the blindfold. Mm. Like there was an image of that, the head of that statue, and a bird was on it. And I was like, this is very literal, you know, and I want something that is, you know, evocative of my idea of justice. It's not so like the way everybody thinks of justice, right? They think of the lady with the, you know, blindfold and the scales. And so, so then I gave them this feedback and I said, you know, I sent them a bunch of these motion studies and, it's like, can you do anything with the birds? And, so this was one of the covers that they sent back in that second round. And when I saw it, it just took my breath away and I knew.
Yeah. It's totally breathtaking just like chills kind of cover. Yeah. When you were writing this book, where were you physically writing the book? Like, do you have an office? Did you go to coffee shops? Like, how did you get it done? I know you teach. Yes. So you also have a day job aside from being a writer. So kind of how did you negotiate that?
Right. So I write a lot in my bed. Okay. I like to work in my bed because it's like the largest surface in my house. Mm. And I sit in my bed and I spread my books and papers and everything all over the bed. And so I work there. I work in coffee shops. Sometimes I work in my office. I work on the road. I work in the plane. You know, I think probably my primary place is in my house. But I do feel like if I'm there, I kind of get into a certain, I can get myself into certain patterns. And then I find myself like using the same phrases all the time or just, you know, I have to kind of get myself out of that very comfortable situation into places that are more foreign or, you know, where there are more people around or different music or, you know, change the context so that I'm able to have a fresh, you know, it gives me a fresh set of eyes.
Right. Do you have writing, snacks or beverages or rituals around your writing?
Yes. I like to eat crunchy snacks, crunchy and salty. And it doesn't really matter what it is, as long as it's crunchy and salty, like tortilla chips. I don't eat flour. So it has to be like a gluten-free cracker or pretzels. I like nuts. Pistachios are really good, though they're a kind of a two-handed snack.
Yeah.
So it's not very, I mean, it's, if I go to the pistachios, I know that I'm like about to not do any writing. I just sit there and eat a snack.
Yeah.
You know, I drink whatever's around, water, coffee. I tend to like make a cup of coffee and then let it get really cold and just sort of sip it all day, which my dentist tells me is very bad for my teeth. But
worse than hot coffee?
Yeah, just to sip, you know.
Have it all day. I see.
Yeah, to sip it all day is bad. You know, I drink wine, whatever. It depends on the time of day and where I am, I think. But always the crunchy snacks are a part of
it. I love that. I love a snack. I love when other people have snacks in their life. Snacks are important to me. What kind of stuff were you reading or listening to or watching while you were doing this work?
I mean, I was reading mostly research. It's hard for me to read for pleasure while I'm working on a book because everything, I end up relating everything to what I'm doing.
Okay.
Unless I'm reading really far outside of my genre that I'm working in. And so I'll read like crime fiction, like thriller crime fiction. Mm. Like I really got into reading like Gillian Flynn while I was working on this, which is kind of the total opposite of what I'm doing.
Right.
Or like Girl on the Train, these sort of like really fast moving, you know, I love them and they're so plot driven. I would not say they're particularly thoughtful, right? Which I don't mean as a criticism, but that's just not the thing that they're doing.
Right.
And so it's just very different from what I was doing and it was kind of fun and I could just do it to unwind or whatever. But mostly I was just reading for research and, you know, I would, you know, find myself stuck and would pull down like some of my favorite, you know, go-to essayists like Rebecca Solnit. I really like her work. And in particular, I turned to her work because I think she's so good at turns, where she'll, you know, be going in one direction on a particular subject, and then she turns in a way. And the way that she does cohesion between those turns is something that I've spent a lot of time studying because I think it's so smart. And just trying to figure out like how she does that, that she's talking now about a very different things, but it seems totally related.
Right.
You know, each essay has its own kind of body of research. And so I would have to, you know, amass my stacks and stacks of books and articles and essays and government reports and everything. And unfortunately, I was mostly reading that. And I'm not able to listen to music that has words when I'm working. So that's a huge deficit. But, you know, there's like channels on like Spotify,
right.
That's like you know, the chill study music or something.
Yeah.
You know,
that was your jam. Just like quiet, no words. Yeah. I feel like that's most common with writers, that they can't have other words. And that makes sense. For me, like, I can read with music, but only if the music is music that I know well. Like, I have to know the song inside and out, know all the words, because otherwise I get distracted with what's happening with the music. So I like something that's chill that I know, like, every single word to. Otherwise, I just go totally silent.
I feel like I'm the opposite way. Like, if I know the words, then all of a sudden I'm like, da, 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 da. like, singing along.
That's interesting. Yeah. For your research, well, I guess, do you like research? Like, is that something that's enjoyable?
Oh, yeah. It's my favorite part of it, really. If I could just do that all the time.
I mean, it seems like, because you took such a wide breadth of topics, like, if you hated research, you'd be like, I'm writing essays on this one tiny thing.
Right.
So it makes sense that you would enjoy that now, thinking about it. Were there any things that you read in your research that you're just like, people should be reading this? Like, this should be in the hands of other humans.
You know, I wasn't reading... most of the research that I was doing was primarily informational, you know, it's not like, oh, this is like this particular report about the radioactivity in the landfill is like required reading for all humans.
Right.
It's dense and it's terrible. And, you know, it takes me forever to like digest it, you know, and that's one example, but, you know, I'm looking up like newspaper articles and, you know, trying to, There wasn't a ton of research that was allowed me to just read for pleasure and, and think about that. And even, you know, engaging with the work of other writers that I admire, I had returned to them looking for specific, you know, ideas or specific pieces of information. So, I mean, unfortunately, I love research, but it does take some of the joy out of reading.
Totally.
But the joy is in the learning, I think, instead of in the pleasure of the reading itself.
Right. Like being like, I learned this amazing thing today.
Oh yeah.
How did you know you wanted to be a writer? Cause you are not just a writer. You teach writing. You have a PhD in creative nonfiction.
No, actually my PhD is in poetry.
Oh, it is. Oops. This is on a podcast.
No, that's okay.
You didn't hear that. but you're a writer and clearly a lover of writing and writers. Like, I guess what I'm trying to say is you're not just writing because you feel compelled to write, but there's a passion that you have around writing, because otherwise, you know, why get a PhD if you don't love the work? So how did you know you wanted to write, and or when did you know, or, you know, and then how did you decide, like, I'm going to stick with this and get a PhD? Because that's pretty major.
Yeah. So I grew up in Missouri in a really small farming town in north central Missouri. You know, and I went to the same school from like second grade, because that's when we moved there, second grade through high school, like the same building, right?
Whoa.
In retrospect, not the best education.
Okay.
You know, I got some bad information while I was there. you know, and I got in trouble in most of my classes. I was in detention a lot, just because I was like, you know, there's a kind of conservative worldview and, you know, ideas about the place of women. And even at that point, it wasn't jiving with me and like how I saw myself in the world. But I had this teacher. Her name was Denise Harvey. She's my English teacher. And she was the only person who thought like her students were capable of more than any of us thought that we were capable. Everybody else thought that we were capable of much less than we were actually capable of. And she's the only person who thought that we were capable of way more. And so, you know, she would have us, you know, read Shakespeare and, you know, write scholarly papers about it. I mean, in retrospect, they're probably garbage, but, you know, doing analysis and literary analysis, and then write creatively and, you know, write poems and stories and everything. And it was fantastic. And I loved it. And also she told me that I was good at it. Mm. And then that made me love it more, because suddenly I was good at something besides getting in trouble.
Right.
I had been good at that, and now I'm good at this other thing. And so when I went to college, like I knew, you know, I I had to negotiate something that a lot of people have to negotiate, which is like, you know, my parents wanted me to do certain things and I was called to do other things. So I changed majors a bunch of times, but eventually I was like, okay, I want to be a journalist. And I applied to the journalism program and I got in, but, you know, I was sort of a pre-journalism person. And they said, you have to take these prerequisites to get in. And one of them was a creative writing class. And so I took this poetry workshop, beginning level poetry for undergrads. And the person who taught that class was getting a PhD in creative writing at that school. And that just blew my mind because I had no idea that that was a possibility, like a thing that you could do. Like you can do this for a job. Like this can be something that you do. And I know that sounds ridiculous at this point, but like I said, I grew up on a farm, on my mom's side, I'm the first person to go to college. My dad has a college degree, but he's an engineer. So it just wasn't within the realm of possibility.
Right.
And so then I was like, okay, well, this is something that I wanted to do. And then, the next class I took, that person had a PhD in literature. And I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. Like, and so then I was just like, that was the thing that I wanted to do. And I wanted to, study books and write about books and talk about books and talk about ideas. And just, that was what I wanted my life to be. And so that was always the plan, was to, I'm going to go to grad school. I'm going to be a professor. And writing sort of almost came secondary to that.
Interesting.
So I, saw that I had the option in pursuing an English major to get a sort of concentration in creative writing. And I did that. And then I graduated with my degree. I was applying to grad school. And that was when I got, I left my ex or left my boyfriend and I got kidnapped and raped. So then that just sort of like turned my life and my thinking. And it's a strange thing to admit, but I am a writer because I've always been trying to find a way to tell that story.
Right.
Then I went on to grad school and have studied writing, and now I'm a professor. So,
yay. So you got there. You did it.
I got there. Yeah,
check.
I did it.
Yeah. So I just have a few more questions for you. One of which is, how did you celebrate on publication day?
What did I do? I got up really early in the morning and came to my office and did a radio media tour or remote media tour. Like I talked to a lot of AM radio stations and, about my book. I think I taught my class and I gave a reading here in Houston. And then there was like a party, later that evening. And so I just, my friends and my community and people here in Houston just sort of got together, but I had to go out the next day and fly somewhere and then I was on tour. So I don't know that I've properly celebrated publication day yet.
Well, yet. You should definitely.
Yeah, I should.
Do you know what comes next for you? Is there another book that you're thinking about, or is it too soon?
I am thinking about another book and I'm sort of on the fence about what it is. I mean, I have maybe three books that I'm going to work on. And one I'll probably just chip away at for years. And that's just like a craft book, a sort of essays about writing. One is a book about the death penalty specifically, because, I found that I'm asked to speak about that and to talk about that a lot. And that is a really, there are some, really entrenched attitudes about justice and punishment and race and poverty around the death penalty, that I feel like I feel called to attend to. But I don't have any idea yet what that would look like or exactly what that would be. One of the things that I've noticed is there's not a lot written about women who are executed. Mm-hmm. Oddly, and I've done just a little bit of research now. I mean, research is my favorite, about like women who have been given the death penalty, and it's interesting, who gets the death penalty and for what. Mm-hmm. And the other project is another book about, let me say, it's about, you know, the connection between environmental justice and racial justice more explicitly. I won't say that it's exactly about climate change, but of course, anytime that you write about the environment now, it's about climate change, but it's about how the way that we define nature, or how our definition of nature contains within it permission to commit violence against the planet and one another. And so that one's probably the one that I'll do first.
I'm so excited. I can't wait. So I guess my last question, or two questions, my second last question is, for people who loved your book, what would you suggest them to read? Is there anything that you feel like is kind of in the same line or just feels like a good connection? It doesn't have to be the same topics, but just something that you're like, this feels similar.
Oh, that's a hard, that's such a hard question. And this is going to sound so arrogant, but I don't think there are any books quite like my book.
There aren't. Not that I've read. Not yet.
No, I haven't either. But I think, you know, there's a lot of books out that I think my book is in conversation with. You know, and I've mentioned some of them, you know, I think like Bryan Stevenson's work is so important. And if you love justice and freedom, like you should totally read Bryan Stevenson's work. You should also go to the Legacy Museum and the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. And if he does not win the Nobel Peace Prize soon, like the committee is not paying attention.
No, he's a total hero. He's such a hero.
He is a hero. He's amazing. You know, David Dow's work, The Autobiography of an Execution. There's been so many amazing books, even just this year. Like, I'm a huge fan of Kiese Layman's book, Heavy. I know you are too.
Yes, huge.
I'm a huge fan of this book by Sarah Ahmed called Living a Feminist Life, which I think is a book that's that combines sort of theory with cultural criticism in a way that's really smart and digestible. Now I'm looking around, like, what have I got laying around? Eloquent Rage is a really good book. White Fragility is a really good book. You know, I think there's, I think we are in a, I won't say a renaissance, because it's not like we're coming back, like coming back to a brilliance that was here before. Like, this is the dawn of a kind of intellectual revolution. And I love the work that's being made today.
I love that. I love that. Those are all really good books. I'm so excited that you mentioned them. So my last question for you is just, if you could have like someone who's reading this book, what's something that you would hope that they would take away from The Reckonings?
Healing, maybe. Sort of just some solace, I guess. I don't know that there's like a single message that I have or a lesson to be learned, as much as just a kind of way of looking at the world that is less cruel and more hopeful and generous, and a way of thinking about justice that, you know, sort of creates opportunities for healing and discovery rather than punishment and pain. So I like the former rather than the latter.
Yes, I'm with you. Well, Lacey Johnson, you're amazing. Thank you so much for coming on The Stacks. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you. You're amazing. I really, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
Yay. And thank you guys for listening, and we will see you in The Stacks. Thank you for listening to The Short Stacks, and thank you to Lacey M. Johnson for joining the show today. A huge thank you also to Cameron Deason Hammond and Scribner for getting The Reckonings into my hands. To help support The Stacks and earn awesome perks, go to patreon.com/thestacks or make one-time contributions at paypal.me/thestackspod. To help support The Stacks and earn awesome perks, go to patreon.com/thestacks, or you can make one-time contributions at paypal.me/thestackspod. Make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening to us through Apple Podcasts, take a moment now to rate and review the show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite. Our theme music is from Tagirages. And this show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas. And I will see you in The Stacks.